This episode of Warp 5 is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for your smartphone, tablet, or desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. Also, help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day by becoming a Trek FM patron through Patreon. Get access to exclusive content and become part of the team. You'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
Hi, I'm Anthony Montgomery, Ensign Travis Mayweather on Star Trek Enterprise, and you're listening to Trek FM.
How we doing, Trip?
Ready when you are.
Prepare for warp.
Course laid in, sir. Request permission to get underway.
Let's go.
Welcome, Boomers, to another episode of Warp 5, Trek FM's dedicated Enterprise show. I'm Norman Lau, and I have to say that I'm really excited about this show tonight because we are wrapping up the very last segment of our deep research and study of all of the Blu-ray seasons. That's right, folks. This is season 4 of Enterprise on Blu-ray, and I have probably the best panel of guests that I can assemble at such short notice. No, I'm just kidding. The best panel of guests that I can assemble because of just their arcane knowledge of the Blu-rays, because we have gone into depth for the last three of them previously on the last three episodes of Warp 5. And this show is going to be no different. We have done our research. We have scoured every single pixel of these, and we are ready to bring these to you. So, in my conference room on the NX-01, we have the content manager and co-host of Warp 5. We have Will Wynn. Will, how you doing?
I'm good. I feel like it's been a long road getting to here, huh, guys?
Getting from there to here.
That's number one. Yeah. It's going to be a lot of those tonight.
And we have Mr. Ataz, our newly minted newlywed, and he has gotten from there to here, but his time is finally near. Jeffrey Harlan. Jeff, how are you?
Oh, I'm doing great. I got some faith of the heart that we're gonna have a good show tonight.
That's three,
and that's yeah, that's faith of the heart, not faint of heart, right?
Ooh, that's good.
Because I'll tell you, a man who is not faint of heart when it comes to loving Trek is Dr. Trek himself, and our special guest for this show. And we probably couldn't do this particular show without him because he pretty much is featured all over season 4 on this special features, and that's Larry Nemechek. Hey, Larry, thanks for coming back with us.
Yeah, well, thanks, guys. Thanks for that. Was fun on season 3, and but you know, if all these sets of all these special docs, I would have to say that definitely these are the voyages.
That was good.
All right, that's our show,
dot,
everyone.
Dot, dot.
That's our show, everyone. Good night.
Yeah, boom, drop the mic, right? So before we get into the good parts of the show, which is all of our collective experiences and watching the special features on the season 4 Blu-ray, Will's going to take you through a little bit of how you can find us here on the network. So, Will, tell our listeners where they can find us and all the different venues that they can download Trek FM and Warp 5.
Sure, you can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course, you can always stream or download the MP3 file from our website at Trek FM and grab the RSS link as well. And if you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us out greatly and makes it easier for other listeners to find the show as they search iTunes. And if you like what you hear on Warp 5 or any other Trek FM network shows, please leave us a 5-star rating and a review because it helps us greatly increase our visibility for our new listeners.
So check out all those ways that you can get to us. And I'm telling you, if there's a way that you can download a podcast for Trek FM, we offer it to you. So you have absolutely zero excuses. And I will find you if you haven't listened to the show by the time it drops. So I'm feeling spry tonight.
Yeah, I feel like there's a lot of high energy. I think it's just because
you're looking spry. Wow.
I feel spry. It must be my T-shirt because I am Star Trek's number one fan.
In this tiny, cramped little NX-01 briefing room, you're looking spry, bouncing off the walls, bumping your head in the beams.
Right, because I know this ship like the back of my hand.
Clunk.
You know, clunk.
Mm-hmm.
So tonight, season four, guys, here it is. The final season, the final Blu-ray set. And there's, I mean, just like all the other seasons, there is a huge amount of special features. And we're going to be talking specifically about one of those. If we can get to both of them, I'd like to, but specifically one, and that is Before Her Time, Decommissioning Enterprise, which is the four-part, not three-part, four-part, 30-minute four-part documentary. So that's 2 hours of a lot of reminiscing, a lot of memories, a lot of tears, a little bit of verklempness on my part. I'm probably sure your parts too. And but, you know, as we've done through the various studies of the Blu-rays, you know, there's a little bit of a technical download that we would like to relay to you. So, Will, there's an article from Blu-ray.com that broke down the series. And they said here that season four basically materializes onto Blu-ray with the highest quality 1080p transfer. That's easily the best the series has looked on this format on Blu-ray. Would you agree with that?
I agree. I think you can tell visually from especially the last two seasons that they were shooting with a higher definition camera. I think Brandon said he didn't like it, but I think it looks great. There's a frenetic energy that you could see from the camera angles, from where they're shooting, just everything. There's an energy that's coming from the cinematography, and the colors are so vibrant. The uniforms are different by the time it comes here. The uniforms are a bit brighter than they were in first season. Everything just pops. The color pops. And of course, it looks fantastic when you see In a Mirror Darkly and you see those TOS sets and then you see the colors really pop. It just wows you. And I think this is visually the best looking set of them all. And it's just arguably, I think it's the best Trek, even better than the JJ Trek in terms of how it looks visually, just visually aesthetic wise. I think it just looks very polished.
Now, Larry, you've had a chance to spend a lot of time probably on set here and there. And was it a challenge for them to always have to make sure the quality was high definition camera ready, because it picks up everything? I mean, it picks up every pore, every seam, every wrinkle in the makeup, every what is hidden, what isn't hidden. You can't really kind of dust these things underneath the rug anymore, you know?
Well, this was, just hearing Will talk about that just reminded me of a whole thing. Because when the show started, I mean, UPN had started with Voyager, so 94. This premiered in 2001. And the HD cameras were coming in and things going digital was kind of a transition. The big thing with season four was, and if you watch the end credits, I remember this, and I even had a couple of the caps that I had in my Trekline trunk that I got out to new homes. But the last season, Sony had a whole, the Alta Vista camera, I want to say. There's a credit for Sony all the way through fourth season in the end titles for their camera system, because fourth season they went totally digital, which was a total first. I mean, to the point where, you know, like there was no huge big camera stand. It was just a little camera. They had flat screen. I mean, this sounds typical now, but this was a huge thing. The first time I walked on a season four set to visit, it just threw me because, like, the bulk was gone. The little, you know, director's table nearby was just a couple of little flat screens. It was not, you know, big infrastructure sitting there. I mean, the sound cart was the biggest thing now, and there was no big little, you know, monument of chairs and stuff that you'd normally have monitors having to sit in because you weren't using the big monitor. It was just so tiny, and it hit me that there wouldn't be a stack of VHS tapes anymore in the writers' mailboxes. They probably weren't even DVDs. They're probably just emailing the dailies around everybody to watch, you know, now, which they probably enjoyed because they could probably have a better control over things leaking out. But it really went 100% digital the last season. And I hadn't even really stopped to think about it until you were mentioning all that. That's probably why they looked better these last couple of years, because they were gradually getting there to the point to where they were. And it's so much so that things were so experimental that I remember walking. I specifically remember it was Borderland and the three-part ones when Brent was on as Dr. Sung, and walking around, and they were doing shows in the ship sets, like the mess hall and the briefing room. And they didn't even have to, I mean, between flat-screen TVs and the HD, they had got to where they could just have, and it was kind of funny because Mike kind of gigged me at the time and said, "Don't tell anybody this." Because it was kind of like we crossed over the guild lines kind of a thing. But it basically got to where they didn't even have to, like, mat in. It was funny because in Next Gen, they would always have to have the ship at rest or at impulse, because it would be X thousand dollars to have warp stars you know, going out the briefing room, the observation lounge windows. So they would always, like, they would have a captain's log of, we have come to a stop while we assess. And then we'd have a meeting in the briefing room instead of having to put warp stars, unless it was a real big story point. But that seemed like Middle Ages, you know, Stone Ages, because now, by the time of Enterprise and things just being digital in general, if they had one of those little oval windows, they could put a plasma screen beyond that and just put a star, you know, if it was going forward, they would just have it lined up the right way and have the warp stars going by, and they could be at warp because they were just running a loop on a plasma screen outside a window. No visual effects, no blue screen, no extra thousand. It's just sitting there. And I remember walking by the first time I saw that and went, oh, well, that's cool. You're able to do that. And Mike is like, yes, but please don't mention that. It was like, art, that's supposed to be visual effects. It's not supposed to be art department, and we're not supposed to be doing it, but we're saving thousands of dollars, so don't tell anybody. So the guilds don't yell at us or something. I mean, it was kind of a thing like that. And I was like, oh, okay. But that, it's like frog in the pot, only for the good thing. It was like the changes that were happening were amazing. But that contrast to the first couple of years, there was a huge scandal the first year. I don't know if you guys talked about it, the first season. There was this circular firing squad blame game because all the early episodes were like muddy and dark. And they were, everybody, after the first few shows came out and people were griping and fans and audience were griping about it. And the show was saying, we're doing the same thing we've always shot at. And they were like Marvin Rush and the camera people were yelling that it was the network and the network transmission people, and or it was the lab because they were still doing film. And they were yelling that Bob Blackman's costumes were too dark. And there was just this, everybody was pointing fingers at everybody else, and people would keep trying to do different things and it wouldn't get better. And then they kind of more and more decided to yell at UPN, and you guys have a cheesy little second-rate transmission system and your tech specs aren't up to it and all that. But the first year or so of Enterprise was, I just remember that was kind of a subtext thing. And I think a lot of fans would always go, why is the damn show so dark? And maybe with the HDs, it's been cleaned up now to where that's not such an issue. I hadn't thought about it until all this, we just got talking about this. But now I want to go back and watch the first season. I wish I still had my VHS tapes of the first year to go back and look at how it actually broadcast out versus what the HDs look like. The HDs, even much less what the DVD Blu-rays look like now. But that was very much a thing. So you talk about an arc from the original muddy to the, oh my God, this is so beautifully sharp. Fourth season, that was a long path.
For our younger listeners, VHS is a magnetic tape that we used to use for our recording devices to record television shows back in the day. So just that's a little bit of...
It was my lifeline when I was growing up in Germany.
All right. Mm-hmm. I know people have, they recorded it and they sent it to their family and stuff like that, mm-hmm. especially on armed services. But Jeff, talking about the quality
that
of
when
the show,
we had to buy the soundtracks on 8-track in 78. Now that was an amazing time.
The collective creak in our bones. That's what you hear over the mic.
Ka-chunk, chunk. Ka-chunk.
So Jeff, when you saw, you're a big fan of TOS. So when you saw this particular set, because this particular set looked so good and you finally saw the recreation of the TOS set on In a Mirror Darkly 1 and 2. I mean, there is nowhere to hide. You have to be textbook perfect, even probably more perfect than the original 66 to 69 sets were. So how did you feel when you saw those?
I was amazed at how good they looked. I was watching it, and I think my initial reaction would not be appropriate for a family show. I was just that impressed. I just loved it. It looked just like the old show, but at the same time better. It's kind of hard to describe that sense that I got when I saw it. I mean, you could tell at a glance, obviously, that's exactly what it was, but at the same time, it's, you know, it just had the production values of a modern show. They didn't change anything, but they changed everything. It's, you know, just kind of hard to describe.
It's almost like if you had any type of like visual impairment and you got a brand new either set of contacts or a brand new pair of glasses, or you just kind of like wipe that thin layer of muck off your windshield and you're like, oh wow, it really is sunny out. Because no, I felt the same way. It was especially with TOS, because you know, it's That's my favorite. It's a lot of people's favorites. And when you see like Relics was really good up to a point. But since they were, you know, that was still shot back in the 80s and it was still at 420.
And Trials of Tribulations, you know, in 96.
And that got, it got better and better. And then you finally got it here in HD when they're actually broadcasting it in 720. You're like, wow. You know, you get to see all the buttons. You get to see all the jujubes. You get to see all the computer discs. You get to see all the stitching. You get to see the amazing transformation they did on Anthony Montgomery's hair. Because I thought his, I thought his,
dude, his high top is so good. Awesome. I want, oh man.
It's shout like fresh out, Prince lots status. Of love. Yeah, lots
DZ
of love
Jazzy Jeff Montgomery. Status. Yeah. It's so good.
Exactly. You know, I mean, he was almost, Kid and Play, man, you know?
Oh, yes. Oh. All right. We should not go on this digression on early 90s music. Okay.
No, I was going to say, I remember, because they did, Herman and Mike and the art department, top to bottom, there were some little things they did to help it out, like, it was the same conceit that when they did the models for mentioned Trials and Tribulations, they did the thing with K7 and the Enterprise and the Klingon that Greg Jean, they built actual new models for Trials and Tribs on DS9 in 96, and the conceit was that yes, there's an extra layer of detail that we have to put on there because it's not 1966 and we can do it and the audience will expect it, but when we do it, the whole point is, we didn't get this close to K7 in 66. If we push the camera in here, here's the, it's like you were talking about wiping the gunk off the windshield. It's like, if we could have gotten this close in 67, here's how it would have looked. So that's what the conceit was. And that's the same thing they did with the bridge on In a Mirror Darkly, even though it was technically the Defiant bridge. It wasn't the Enterprise, but everybody got the wink.
Yep.
But, they did some things like, instead of just having the static, you know, rear projected, you know, upper bridge, the view screen, they would introduce something and they would have like little bitty bits of motion. Like if it was one of those spectrograph color bars or some lights or some like Starfield, they'd put just a little bit of a twinkle or a little bit of a bar advance motion or something. And normally a camera wouldn't, you know, like, and now we're going to put a camera on the upper deck platform above communications for 5 minutes. No, that's not going to happen. But just those passing pans, or just for a few seconds it would be up there, there'd be just a little bit of motion so that on one hand it didn't glaringly conflict with what you remember, you know, right, lovingly. But at the same time, your subconscious would get the idea that you weren't seeing a poster slapped up there. You know, it wasn't 1960, or it wasn't a rear projected slide up there. There was actually a little bit more technology going on. Just like we've all kind of retconned the idea that the jujube buttons, you know, Matt Jeffries' thing, they're not just single, like that they're reprogrammable. You know, there are different overlays that they mean this with this overlay, they mean this with another overlay, which is the only way it's going to make sense. So there was something, and they did some things like, instead of having just the 2x4 red railings, just butt, that I remember Herman talking about, like rounding the corners on those so they were a little bit rounded instead of just a straight, you know, 2x4 cut.
Right.
So there were a few little things they did like that around the set, but that's not like 2%, 3%. Otherwise, my whole thing was, when I saw that and then I saw it on film, like watching it on plasma, it was like, yes, once and for all, this whole plywood Christmas lights, you know, cardboardy knockdown that everybody'd always thrown at the original series sets, you know, like, oh, they're so cheesy, and oh, they're so 60s and cheap, and here we're putting it under the HD microscope, and look how awesome they look.
Yeah.
So take that. You can do it. You can shoot this. And, you know, and Phase 2 New Voyages had been out by then, and some of the other fan films were going, and they were doing different versions of that just on a little fan film budget. And they were already looking hot that way. But this is once and for all. This is network TV, digital cameras. It's like, take that. Those original series sets look awesome.
Yep.
You know, even in modern technology and modern lighting and modern camera and all that. So there, you can do another show on those sets. Take that.
And to punctuate that, before we move on to the next segment, that for me was the truest Valentine of Enterprise over anything else. I mean, I just have to say that. I hope you agree with me out there in listening land, because they did a great job on it, and it shows, and it's worth watching. So,
And one thing that, before we continue on to the next point, that I really appreciated was something that Mike Okuda brought up when they were interviewing him, was he was talking about the little blinking lights that they had in the background, and you had just all these square multicolored lights, And what they did on the Enterprise interface, how in the first season they had one row of the square blinking lights, second season they had two, and by the fourth they had three. And I never even noticed that detail until he mentioned it. Now I can't help but notice it, that they were slowly making it more and more look like the original series computer interface.
It was the old adage. It's if they're doing the special effects job right, you won't notice it at all.
Mm-hmm.
And he did.
And it worked perfectly, and I never even noticed it until he pointed it out.
But if they got to a fourth season or a fifth season or sixth season, eventually you would have had a Matt Jeffries solid row of rectangular. Mm-hmm.
By then I would have noticed it, yes.
Yeah.
Okay, so we have, I mean, the visuals were great. The audio is still in the same fantastic DTS 5.1 surround. It's probably sounds the best that it's ever been. And it's just because as the films or as the seasons went on, it's just the quality of it was recorded just substantially better over and over and over this different season. So production value aside, it's just a fantastic set. We're going to rate it later, but I'm pretty sure that you already know what our ratings are going to be. So we're going to get into probably the quintessential part of this show, and that is the four half hour.
It's two segment. Hours long.
2 hours long. You're right, Will. 2 hours long of great memories, bittersweet moments, incredible insights, some shocking, some not so shocking, because I think a lot of us know what was going on by this time if you've watched all of the documentaries throughout seasons 1 through 3 on the Blu-rays. But we're talking about, I hate saying this word, decommissioning Enterprise, or these words, because it is. It's not just the end of a series. It's the end of Star Trek. And there were, I understand, and Larry, we're going to get your thoughts on this. I understand how this progressed, and I think a lot of the listeners and a lot of the boomers out there understand the history of it. But when you watch these documentaries, you really get an emotional, tactile, visceral, raw sense of how much emotion was just pouring through all these people at this time. A lot of positive, a lot of negative, and I think Jolene probably a lot of negative, when especially when it came to the end. So, Will, why don't you start us off with part one of Decommissioning Enterprise, and it was called New Voices, and it had to deal with Manny Coto coming in.
Right. So I think that's the big crux, right? Everyone said, you know, season three changed the game in terms of the formula, but season four was a completely new showrunner, and he brought in a completely different philosophy in terms of how he wanted to do the stories. And I think it's one of those really interesting things because it's such a shift, yet it's not a radical shift, right? The shift was bringing it back into the Star Trek mythology, the continuity, and in a way it should have been the first season. So many times throughout that first part they kept on saying, like, this is what they should have done in the beginning. Of course, hindsight is always 20/20, and it's something that isn't readily apparent if a show is first running. But I think that was the key point, is that Manny came in season three and he was relatively surprised that he was given the showrunner responsibility season four. I think there was some I think there was some issue with potentially Chris Black taking over as executive producer, but he didn't. He ended up leaving, and it was Manny Coto, who was this relatively newcomer in season three, but had a love for Star Trek, and that started to translate into season four. And of course, they had to immediately address what happened at the end of season three, that cliffhanger right at the end, right? It leads into Stormfront, that cliffhanger, which I think is such a wonderful Machiavellian move in terms of just making a cliffhanger, because the network would hate it, and because the network would be faced with such vehemence from the fans that they would cancel show in the middle of cliffhanger. I think it was brilliant, the fact that they mentioned that. We just threw it in there. We didn't know what was going to happen. The show was already talked about being canceled in season three, let alone continuing beyond season four. So I think it was, so they had to resolve that. And on top of that, begin kicking into these, almost, I think they mentioned it in the documentary, they wanted to do these mini novels, these mini anthologies. And I think it really just changed the show for the better.
So what do you think, Jeff? Well, I mean, starting off with New Voices, what really struck you in this first 30-minute segment?
Well, I loved the choice of episodes that Manny Coto mentioned as his favorites from the original series. He mentioned that he really liked Amok Time, Doomsday Machine. He also mentioned
Who Mourns for Adonis, right?
Yeah, Who Mourns for Adonis. And there was even talk about Stratos and from the Cloudminders. And, I mean, it's just all these little references that I just love because I'm an original series fan, too. You know, it's the little things like that that really, that's what I enjoy seeing and hearing.
I mean, he was really excited about Colonel Green. Mm-hmm. He dropped Colonel Green's name a lot, you know, through this. And Manny is, I mean, here's the one thing that I find really interesting. And Larry, I would like to get your thoughts on this. Manny is a true fan of the original series. And very seldomly, especially even today, you don't really see a lot of people that are true fans of the original series coming into work on Star Trek. You have people that know Star Trek. You have people that are really good writers and really good directors and really good creatives. But, you know, you can really tell when somebody who knows the material becomes influential on really good Star Trek writing and Star Trek producing because they know the material. They know how to bring that through line into the series, and it's almost too bad that we got Manny a little too late, don't you think?
Well, this could be a whole book
called Coto Trek. What if
Coto Trek? Well, I mean, it's no the whole. If you go back and look at modern, start with the beginning of Next Gen, when you go to the point where not just writers. I mean, Star Trek became a thing thanks to Next Generation and thanks to the Geek Revolution, where it was okay to come out of the closet and embrace all your sci-fi-ness, including Star Trek. There's just a spectrum going from reassembling the people to start doing Encounter and Farpoint in 87 all the way to the end of Enterprise. That's 18 years. And along the way, at the beginning, you would have crew people. Like, no one could be... It's amazing that Mike Okuda and Rick Sternbach ever got hired on as tech advisors and started advising people on the side about Trek stuff, and which is what the tech manual grew into. We went from their memos on the show into doing a book. But apart from them, it's like if you let it be known to the production office beyond like Gene and then like Richard Arnold and Susan Sackett working with him. But outside of like Gene's office staff, if you let it be known that you were a fan and you were just a random crew person, if anything was ever turned up missing or stolen or whatever, then you were on the immediate, like, suspect list. It was like the first few years of Next Gen were really... If you were a fan, you just kept it to yourself. And that was just the lowly crew people, you know, like, especially PAs and assistants and all that, much less kind of in the crew somewhere. Because they were just paranoid about stuff. Because stuff would get stolen, but it would be people randomly just getting onto the sets. Or it would be stuff, scripts and things would go out to the vendors off lot. And those were like a sieve. No, nobody ever thought of those people. Much less than people with the key, like you said, Norm, people with the keys that had the power to do things, writers and designers and that kind of thing. Now, that's where Mike and Rick come in very famously and started putting the in-jokes and the Okudagrams, and not just in-jokes, but cool things, right? And gradually, that didn't really happen after David and Dorothy left at the beginning of Next Gen, most of the writers that came in weren't really... fans, kind of fans. I mean, Michael Pilbara was kind of a fan. Ira was an old fan. But when they bought little boy Ron Moore sold his script in third season, he was, you know, dyed in the wool, I will talk titles and quotes with you all day long fan, right? And then you kind of got Ron, and then Rene Echevarria was the same way, and Naren Shankar, not Brannon, but that first, the coterie of the guys that were running Next Gen under Jerry and Michael toward the end, who were not old Star Trek fans, they're professional writers. But the wave was starting to come up where people were getting old enough they could both be fans and, you know, learning writers. But all through that, then you get into the Brian Fuller, you know, then you get the Voyager and DS9 and some of the new ones coming on by then. And Ken Biller was kind of a fan too, but not quite as crazy as some of the rest of them. And then Mike Sussman coming in, and then, of course, Andre there too. But that my point is that as the years went by, the needle got bigger and bigger, and it was okay to be out of the closet, and it was finally seen as a benefit, you know, instead of, God forbid, you know, like a detraction, that, okay, well, so you're a big Star Trek fan, but we need you to write, to really write. You know, like, don't put the terms fanboy and fan service didn't exist, but that's what was floating in the atmosphere. So, yeah, so by the time, what's hysterical is by the time you get to Enterprise, where the whole show is about leading into the original series, and you've got, you know, Ron is not involved, which I've talked about before, was a great disappointment to hear, because I knew that Mike and Brannon and Rick's hearts were not with the original series. They knew it existed and they respected it, but I think Rick one time said that, or maybe this is not fair, or somebody, or maybe he thought it was a compliment, said something, or maybe it was Manny, said, you know, it struck him like, he says, basically the way he talks about it, it's kind of like James Bond in space or something. But, you know, the adventure and the girls and the derring do, but whatever, because of the time it was made also. But you finally had more and more of that coming in. And the whole point of Manny being there, Chris Black, some of the other ones could have done the same thing. I always felt bad about Enterprise's evolution because a lot of people, not just the writers, wanted, they totally got it, what they thought it should be, which is what the fans thought it should be, which is, here's what Kirk's world was like 100 years early, and here's how we get from Zefram Cochrane to Kirk, right? Mm-hmm. And the Federation and all of that, and maybe even the Romulan War at the beginning and all that. And that kind of, it was almost like that kind of spun around like a, I don't know, like a car stuck in reverse and the steering wheel cocked to the side or something. And it wasn't until all the craziness happened with the ratings and all the evolution of the show happened and the situation came up to where Manny came in and then took over that finally, apart from maybe arguing that's what Ira was doing on DS9, but they were dealing with what they had to deal with at the time. Like Ira and that crew were doing DS9 and telling the big arc of Dominion War and going through that and trying to service all the characters, all their 40 running characters. But at the same time, they would throw in a mention of an Andorian ambassador or a Tellarite ambassador or, you know, Tholian silk or whatever. And they would put that original series stuff in there for fun.
And fans would perk up to that.
And of course they would. Of course they would. But thinking at the time, oh, there's no way we're ever going to get to show a Gorn or a Tholian because it's beyond our effects budget. And somebody will go, oh, will you stop with the original series fan service or whatever, you know, fanboy stuff. So that by the time you were to this point, I mean, I was shocked when they said they were going to do the Andorians because Rick's original take on the Andorians was, you know, the Bolians are what the Andorians were after they said, no way, we're not going to have antennaed, blue-skinned, bug-eyed monster things in Star Trek. That's what Rick's edict was.
So Mr. Mott was Imperial Guard.
Right, exactly, yeah. Exactly. Just put a wig on him and you can see. So the fact that they were going to have Andorians come in, I was just like shocked when I heard that. I mean, I was thrilled but shocked, and I just knew something would happen. When I heard they were going to be the radio control antennas, I was like, fine, that will botch. It'll look horrible. It'll be a pain. It won't work totally right. It'll look horrible on camera. They'll have to simplify it. And then somebody will say, see, this is why we don't do Andorians. Because it would all be about the RC. I mean, I just knew that was going to happen. Right. And it didn't. And I was like, oh my God, I can't believe something actually like went right for once. But the bottom line is, like, Manny coming in was the guy who was standing there the right time in the right place. I was hoping, like, Chris had been trying to do the same thing. Mike and Phyllis, a lot of the writers in Enterprise, if they had been unrestrained, and you know, you had Mike Okuda on the and Doug Drexler on the art staff, and you had Mike Westmore and Herman, all the people in the design, and all the Dan Curry and all the visual effects people, they were all rip raring to go. Whatever they designed the Terra Nova. What was the ship in Terra Nova? Was it Terra Nova? They designed a ship that was very DY-100-ish looking, 3Y-100-ish looking.
Yeah. Conestoga, yeah.
The Conestoga, thank you. And I remember them designing that way, and then visual effects going, well, it looks like a pencil. Just do a saucer in the cells. I mean, that was the... And anytime anybody creatively would, either from their gut or going to research, like anybody professional would do, to do those nods of a lead-in, it would get either accidentally or on purpose, kind of whittled down.
Did that come from the network, or did that come from
that
Rick
came
or Manny,
from
or
that
Brandon?
Came from the Cooper Building. So the fact that it got to the point where the show was on life support and they were like, no, you guys step back and let somebody else run it the last year, and that's the only way we'll agree to this last year. And then Manny almost apologized, and then getting the space Nazis, surely they get into this on the thing. I'm trying to remember if they do now. I just know it. When they were originally going to do 6 shows, and they got it down to 2 because he's like, this is going to be the last year. We've only got 20 slots. And I remember him almost apologizing to me at one point, the big interview we did at the end of the year, and him saying, hey, what I have done, you know, if anybody thinks, why does every single episode or every single little mini arc have a original series lead-in? Would we have done that if we'd been in better shape? No, but it's like I looked at it as if I've only got 20 more hours before Star Trek is off the air forever, for a long, long, long time. And we've got things that have never been told, and we've got a few things that we should tweak and adjust and maybe fix, like the Vulcan arc, and make it be an arc and not just this thing we went down this path. Oh, no, we meant all along to bring it back around this way. So
actually, I think that's the perfect segment into the second part of the documentary, because Manny actually goes into, I have my one shot. I'm going to take my one shot, and I'm going to do it the way you asked me to be the showrunner. You know, I gladly came in season 3 to help iron out a couple things, but then, you know, the off season, Brandon calls me up and he says, I'm out. I can't do this anymore. It's just not in my heart. I'm tired. I'm exhausted. You're showrunner. And I'm pretty sure when he said that, Manny said, okay, I'm going to reach into my deep bag of hindsight and I'm going to do the show that I want to do. So Will, when you watched the second part, Memorable Voyages, it was a segment about pretty much how Manny wanted to do the series from, if he actually had the chance to run it from season 1. And I know how much you love the 4th season. I think a lot of us TOS fans love the, no, you actually, Will hates the 4 seasons.
I hate Star Trek. Well, I'm even on this show, yeah. Actually.
but in Memorable Voyages, there had to have been something there, one of the stories or anecdotes.
It's true.
You know, what was your favorite anecdote in that sequence?
Before I get into that, actually, Norm, I just want to say, Larry, you look really good in HD, I must say, because you're front and center in this segment, right? You're the first person talking, yeah. Right?
And in that same little auditorium with the little brown green seats,
you look really good in 1080p, I must say. So, with that said, I think my favorite anecdote is, you know, like you said, Norm, is that he was really going for broke, and how prescient he was. I mean, it was almost prophetic in terms of, you know, he thought that this was not just the end of Enterprise. This was the end of Star Trek for the foreseeable future, and that's true to this day. It's present. Like, what happened in the 4th season, what they packed in there in terms of the world building, was so important to everything else, to the entire mythos of Star Trek. I think that can't be understated, and it's.
I don't want to take anything away from that, but because Manny was, but. Everybody starting 4th season, it was like 80%, 90% knowing that that was it.
Right.
I know they didn't want to tell the fans that, but that's was the writing on the wall. Because the 4th season was the totally back from the dead year. There are so many things about, now, let me just say one real quick more thing about Manny, about coming in and that decision to make him showrunner that I don't think is on here anywhere, but it struck me. There are so many things in hindsight, and the more the years have gone by, that Enterprise so much reminds me of the original series, almost like the circles come full circle. One of them is the borrowed time years, like it should have been canceled, but they borrowed another year, only instead of 3 instead of 2, they wound up with 4 instead of 3. And the way that like DVD time shifting and people, you know, remote recording at the time was kind of overlooked and made fun of, and now it's very much a part of it, factors into ratings. And back in the early days, demographics would have made Trek. Like Brandon says on the writer's reunion, today's numbers alone would have made Enterprise a huge hit. But the other thing that struck me as years, I remember when Manny came in, he was kind of like the mystery like writer that came in mid-season, and there was a real good, you can see the way they laugh and pal around on the writer's side. They were all pretty good friends there. And I just remember Manny was this like mysterious guy, and he had his own assistant, and I just was going to like walk by and say hi to him, and his door was always shut, and it was really hard to get to him. And I was like, wow, is this going to be like the guy that's hard to get to? And I hope he's around long enough, because I really am trying to get to everybody the more the years have gone by and the more people have been more comfortable with me being around and I had the access. And I finally remember talking to his assistant toward the end of the year, and I said, hi, I'm Larry, and I'd really like to sit down and talk to Manny about the season, but I hope, do we think he'd be up for that? And she said, oh, totally, totally. He'd love to. He'd love to. He just wants to get through the year first. And I said, oh, okay, that's great, that's great. And between that and other little bits, I remember hearing, I think some of the other guys that were on the tape and some of the writers, Manny was the guy that, and this may be what ultimately led Brannon and Rick to go with him when they stepped back. Manny was the guy that would like go in his office, shut the door, and do a script in 2 or 3 days. Like, because his first one was Similitude, right? Mm-hmm. And everybody loved it. But he basically, he did not, somebody, he may have said himself at some point, he didn't come in and jawbone around and goof off. Not that everybody was goofing off, but he was the cut and dried guy that came in, shut his door, and actually worked in his office in the day, all day long. And then at the end of the day, at the end of the year, he was great to come sit. And it really struck me as the years have gone by how that was exactly the way Gene Kuhn was on the original series. Gene Kuhn was like a writing machine, and he saved Gene's butt by coming in when Gene would get exhausted because he was, the whole thing was on his shoulders. And he was a writing machine, basically, and was able to crank stuff out and under pressure and just get the stuff done and have it be wonderful. And that's kind of where Manny came from. And I think you're talking about Brannon being exhausted and worn out. I think they just saw Manny as this wind him up and let him go. And the stuff he does is pretty good stuff. And I really think it just was a wonder. I think that was his writing skill. The fact that then on top of that, he happened to be, you know, Ron Moore caliber fanboy for Trek was just like the wonderful, miraculous bonus. But I just wonder, and I don't think that really got, that wasn't an insight that I don't think is anywhere on these. But I just remember at first, I remember a couple of the vibes from the rest of the staff, like Manny was not antisocial, but that he just kept to himself. And who was this enigma? And he was, you know, perfectly good to kid around. And he's been interviewed tons of times. But I just think that's kind of what got him the job, that he showed that he was capable of doing. That was the work first, not the fact that he was going to do this season that all fans were just going to love, love, love for eternity.
Do you think there was,
just throw that in,
do you think there was resentment, Larry, of him being a relative newcomer and then having showrunner status put upon him for the fourth season?
I think that was in there, yeah, in the mix of things, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult. I think it
didn't want to dwell on it, but yeah, I think so. And but that's also the nature of the business. Right. Things happen.
Yeah, because you had like guys like, you know, Andre and Mike and Chris, they were all there 1, 2, 3 seasons, and all of a sudden, you have.
But then the other question though is, well, gee, why did it have to take being backs against the wall to be canceled before, you know? Oh, this is just a whole can of worms. But it's like, it's too bad that, some, like I kept saying, Manny was in the right place at the right time, but there were a lot of people on that staff who could have, you know, I told the story about originally the Osarians that were in that early Zindi show. Mm-hmm. Mike mm-hmm. Sussman wanted to, he was like, oh, why don't we make them Orions? The ones that stole the goods from Archer, from Enterprise, and then said, and taunted him later on about, yes, you won't always be so a goody-goody, and there'll come a time in here when you're faced with, which they came back to, right? Made that full circle.
And Damage. Yeah.
And he originally had said, let's have them be Orions, because that fit. This is before Borderland, right? And at the time, Brannon, he told me, Brannon's reaction was, really? Green skin? Oh, that's so 60s. That's so original series. No. So, as you know, in the joke was, he said, so they became Osarians. So it's like, what is that, Irish dinosaurs? But... But that's the kind of thing that happened all the time with the visual and with the writing both. Always trying to do that stuff. And it either would get ignored or shot down or pushed to the side or thought of as not important. So that same reaction you talked about, people like when Ira and those guys would throw it into DS9, even just mentions, much less, oh, this is supposed to be the show that's leading in the original series. That kind of stuff, you know, until Manny got the keys, that kind of stuff really didn't happen.
So back on your anecdotal memory, Will.
Sorry, Will.
No, no worries. No, this is just.
I mainly want to say that about. I really think Manny is kind of the on top of the things people think of him for, like, oh, he got so much original series lead-ins in there. He was kind of, to me, he's also kind of the Gene Kuhn of this show that kind of came in, was a shining light of relief and steadiness for exhausted Rick and Brannon.
Right. I think. I think the thing that was also interesting about the second feature was because the budget was so tight, they had to stretch out the arcs, right? They had to do two-parters, three-parters, so they can amortize the cost of the sets over time, over multiple episodes. But I think it's so interesting, and I think it's so validating, the fact that what was originally a cost-saving or a budget-saving measure ended up creating a venue or an avenue for even better storytelling because it's three parts. You can tell a more cinematic feel. You can tell the Augment arc. You can tell the Kirshara. You can tell the Babel 1 arc. And it's so fitting because they brought in the Rhys Stevens. They brought the novelist for Federation to tell these types of mini movies or these mini novelettes, if you will. And they did that because initially it was a cost-saving measure. They had to stretch these budgets further, right? And I think it was so fortuitous, like you mentioned, Larry, that so many things came in the right place for this fourth season to be what it was. And one of it was the fact that they were doing these types of three-part arcs.
Well, again, I think Mike Okuda said this once. It's the same kind of thing, throwback to original series, where if they didn't have much money, and if they'd had a ton of money, the Enterprise could have looked like the Jupiter 2 interiors on Lost in Space because it was the mid-60s. Oh, look, it's a million blinking lights. It must be a really advanced computer. And they didn't have all that money, so instead it's this real spare design that made you think, and they did a lot with little, and now people praise that as being, oh, it's so minimalist, and oh, it's, you know, it's
like nothing we've ever seen before.
It's like nothing we've ever seen before. But it hints at the power. It doesn't. It's not in your face and on the nose. It's, well, that's a pretty damn powerful starship, and look how simple their bridge looks. Wow, that must be an incredibly complex and sophisticated practical design. Well, it is a bunch of Christmas lights in plywood. But the conceit and the way they sell it, you know, the way the acting and the writing uses it. But again, it's lemonade out of lemons. And it's the same thing. It's that same thing too, yeah.
Well, there's nothing there's nothing cooler than, like, you know, the C57D. I mean, you know, it's sparse and powerful at the same time. So, but I mean, Jeff, you're a big fan of the Star Trek novels and the books and the mm-hmm. Rhys Stevens work and Federation. I know you've brought up Federation many times. And when Manny brought them in, now you're really seeing a great wealth of knowledge from the original series, and you could feel that influence. What do you think they brought in the most that helped Manny just start to shape this entire fourth season as something that befit a true tie-in and Valentine to the original series?
Well, it's all the little touches that they brought in, you know, with the Vulcan arc, things like they insisted on having a Saylot, you know, And they knew that they could only have it for a couple of shots, and so they only wrote in a couple of shots. And then they said that the effects team then went and made like 27 shots, and then they told them to cut it back down to 3, which is what they wrote.
They should have really put in those additional 24 extra shots of the Saylot in the Blu-ray set, because I feel like might as well.
We need an extended edition.
Yeah, we need the extended edition with them being chased by a Saylot for 10 minutes.
I'd watch it. I'd watch it.
Things like that, the having a LRPA for the first time since the 60s, and you know, all the little things like that being thrown in there, when they brought in the mirror universe stuff, was that they were talking about the ideas that they had for doing a mirror universe story with bringing in Shatner. Even though it fell apart because of the money issues with trying to get Shatner to come onto the show, that was just a really cool story that they had from mm-hmm. that. That would have just been amazing to see on the show, and to bring Shatner in would probably have brought in a lot of other fans who had not been watching the show for various reasons, and be like, oh, you know, they got Captain Kirk back on Star Trek again. I got to go see that. It's just a shame that didn't work out.
Or materialize.
Buzzing.
Was paying attention out there.
Especially given the storyline that they had, which involved the Tantalus field and transporters.
Well, just the background they were able to bring on the Vulcan trilogy,
and
bring up Vulcan's Forge, which had been in yesteryear. But to get in the point that a lot of people forget, it's not like the Vulcans almost killed them. You know, like you talk about Namuk Time and in all the original series, clues about how the Vulcans always destroyed themselves with their passions. And it's not a bunch of ancient Vulcans running around on their pet cellets throwing spears at each other. The fact that when...
That's a great visual, by the way. Oh, my God.
I would love to see that.
There you go. That's yeah, there's your throwback series. Yeah. That's the next prequel series. Vulcans on cellets with spears.
Just do it for one episode on a DTI show.
Yeah. No,
I feel like a very gritty Game of Thrones-esque style.
No, that's going to be the Klingon series.
Oh, that's true. That's true.
Yeah, Game of Kronos.
Oh, man. All right, we can't go down this tangent. It's too
good. Can't go that. But no, but it was instead of that image, though, what you got out of the Vulcan arc was kind of a slap in the face that, well, remember, guys, if there was a diaspora where the discontented Vulcans left and became Romulans, they had interstellar ships. So these are not ancient Vulcans running around on cellets with spears. And the fact in that show, they make the point of saying, yes, there were like nuclear exchange, there were atomic bomb exchanges on Vulcan. And that's what Vulcans for, like in the writers' reunion, they talked about their melted green glass. That's such a striking visual that they had atomic bomb detonations on Vulcan, that they got that far. So when Spock says, we nearly wiped each other out with our passions, it wasn't like, what's his name, the Scottish movie?
Braveheart.
Yeah, it wasn't a Braveheart kind of like tribal Nordic and Scots, like, you know, Angles wiping each other out. It was atomic warfare, pushing buttons, wiping each other out, and then the Romulans, what became Romulans left. Because they had interstellar craft.
Armageddon kind of way. A real war.
Yes,
kind of
yeah, a real war. But that all, yeah. That got solidified into canon, slapping you in the face, you know, realizing that that's where Spock comes from, that's where the modern Vulcans come from, and that's, yeah. In the immediate era, it's been 500-600 years since then, but that's where, or whatever. Somebody's going to yell at me if I'm off on my timing, I haven't looked. But that's what they were coming from. But for that to all get into, and then to have, you know, early T'Pau was just icing on the cake.
I just want to, yeah, I mean, that's, for me, like, there was a, and it wasn't in this segment, but I know that's been talked about, and it's because of royalties that they couldn't name T'Pau,
right.
T'Pau.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The Theodore Sturgeon estate. They were going to do that, and then they realized every episode they'd have to pay X amount of money to. But, you know, doing it for a guest role on a couple episodes wasn't a big deal.
Yeah, because that's, for me, that's probably my favorite memory out of all of the different little tidbits, because T'Pau is, she's legendary. It's a Mock Time.
It's like, know? She's all a Vulcan rolled in one package.
Right. Mm-hmm. And when I said, oh, why not? It just made so much sense. We're like, darn it.
Yeah.
You know, but when I saw her here, it's like, you know what? They're going to swing for the fences. They're going to pay what they need to pay. They're going to, you know, write that check that, you know, Archer's body can't cash, and or maybe Trips did, you know. Too soon? No, I don't think so. So, but there were a lot. I mean, that's just what we talked about, folks. I mean, we kind of like get on with the show, but that's just the tip of the iceberg with this. And again, probably one of the better sequences of just going down memory lane and seeing what Manny Kota wanted to do and what the Reef Stevens were able to bring and how that collective TOS influence and love was able to forge for this fourth season. Because for any of the fan bases, I know that Enterprise has a great fan base and they're loyal, but bringing in the TOS fan base for what they were doing was just really remarkable. And being able to bridge that between TOS and Enterprise fans was even more special, because you just kept perpetuating that history.
I just want, real quickly, I just want to say that my memory at the time, now we were in a wholly different vibe. We're in the whole vibe, like where, like I said, Doug Drexler says, the new fans of Enterprise don't know that they're supposed to have hated the show. But the new generation.
That's true, yeah.
I remember at the time realizing that it was really odd, because there were a whole lot, you know, the fandom had split during the Voyager DS9 years. Just a lot of people, it's just like the numbers, and people had their favorite. And the unified next-gen boom years quickly, you know, oh, no, we'll have a lot more. Well, people were not watching all shows, and sometimes that was problematical for people, whatever. But I remember thinking, as the Voyager numbers went down, the perception was, and Enterprise started off, there were a lot of people who had been that original, oh, it's not Kirk, Spock, McCoy, so I'm not going to watch Next Gen. There were a lot of people who had, like, gone underground when they were young adults and had their families and not kept up with Star Trek. I remember hearing and getting a vibe of a lot of original series people who had been underground and not even like paid attention to the whole next-gen DS9 Voyager era were actually kind of coming out of the woodwork and curious about Enterprise. It was like, but I mean, it was too little too late, and the numbers were still small, and it was like they had an uphill, after the first year or two, they had an uphill battle. But I remember hearing from a lot of people who were watching Enterprise then, weekly, first run, who had kind of ignored modern Star Trek, but they were intrigued because it was supposed to be a lead into Kirk's Spock. It just was too little too late. But some, that thread of the appeal was actually working on some levels.
There's a really interesting revival right now about that period of time between like 2151 and probably like the end of Kirk's era, where you have Enterprise and the resurgence of love there because of all the different ways you can get it. Then you have like films like Axanar, you know, Star Trek Continues, and Pacific 201. I mean, there's a lot of love in that era because I think it's the, I'm going to quote Scotty here, that's the era where you could feel what warp speed you were going by the way the deck plates were vibrating. It wasn't safe still. And I think that there's still a set amount of romanticism involved when it comes to, in Archer's speech at the very last episode, you know, it's like every time you turn around the corner, there's going to be something more noble and more wondrous to see. And I think when you go to, you know, Next Generation and DS9 and Voyager, I always felt that, well, maybe not so much Voyager, because I think Voyager was a little bit more of the TOS type of flavor, but the Federation was already, I'm going on a huge tangent, but bear with me. The Federation was already established. They were just pretty much doing maintenance, in my opinion. You know, they were you know, ferrying around diplomats back and forth. They were making sure that the status quo was okay. All of a sudden, you know, the Klingons have the Civil War. We got to take care of that. But the Federation's okay. They're not really exploring. They're more like maintaining. Then you have the Cardassian uprising, and they're like, okay, we'll bring the Bajorans into this. We'll bolster them. We'll bolster our defenses around all the deep space stations. You have Deep Space Nine. It's not exploration. It's not stagnant, but it's not exploration. You know, when you get to Deep Space Nine. So, but next generation, I mean, you know, TOS and Enterprise, it's all about, are we even going to make it to the next mission? Is that going to happen? Are we going to run out of food? Are we going to explode? You know, or what's going to happen? It always felt like...
Are our weapons going to be too inferior to the next guys we meet down the line?
Yeah, like Silent Enemy, Right. Our phasers, they have no effect. Are we going to be able to fight off those people that like strapped up the Axanar in fight or flight? Are we going to be able to talk to them? Is the universal translator going to work? Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of those expectations that aren't readily met in this era, and it's something that we take for granted when you see like really high tech science fiction. You know, it's.
I'll say this though, Norm. I think it was brought up in the features too. That's a really good point about this era, which is why I also like this era too, and I like the 24th century. But there's an appeal to this era too. But I think there was a really important point that was brought up. I think it was it either Chris or Mike Sussman. I think, or maybe it could have been even John Billings. He said that there's a moment in the Broken Bow where Trip was talking about, well, we've already gotten rid of poverty and war and disease, when he's talking to T'Pol about the accomplishments that humanity should feel proud about. And, you know, and T'Pol is trying to put a wet blanket on that. Like, well, you haven't really done a lot. And he's like, we've done a lot already. And I think that's right there, is it was beginning to answer those questions. But because of the friction of the tension that Enterprise had to be, where it had to be a prequel but not too much of a prequel, I think you had beginning to explore the rougher edges of humanity, but a lot of that had already been settled, right? The fact that their united Earth was still peaceful and they had solved all those big problems, it's the ultimate tension of Enterprise, where it wants to be the prequel, but it's being hindered in a lot of ways that it can't really fully explore its premise. Which is why I really want that show still, right? I really want the show that Enterprise should have been, the true prequel that was right after First Contact, Zeff from Cochrane, but even before Archer now, right? So how literally did we get to stop killing each other, right? How did we, you know, end disease and poverty on this grand scale? And for me, that still hasn't been told yet. It's still just kind of, we've glossed over that. And we've done some different things, and that's not to take away from what Enterprise contributed. But for me, there's still that gaping hole. Like, there is still a lot to explore right there in that time era.
No, that's true. And gosh, I wish we had infinite time, but you know, that's Well, you're gonna have to write that down for another show topic, and Larry, we're gonna have to bring you back for that.
Gonna write it down. I'm using the retro paper they use in the cage, where they apparently just have paper that they're just have like a three wing binder where they just flip it over. Like, okay,
done. His little metal clipboard in his room. Yep. I love that. Yeah, much less on the bridge output. No, I mean, I just love this because I was just sitting here thinking how many parallels I'm getting slapped with a wet noodle here on these things. Like, because when Enterprise came out, there was almost like a mini echo of the whole, and I kind of touched on a minute, you know, when Next Generation premiered, it was a Gene Roddenberry created show, and you had a chunk of fandom that could not accept the fact they weren't redoing, they weren't wiping out Kirk, Spock, and McCoy and that whole time period and everything that had happened. They were doing the genius thing of moving 80 years. They weren't rebooting and recasting. They were going 78 years. I remember that. 78 years in the future. They were doing that. So all of that was still canon and was still honored, but this was new. This was 100 years later, and the challenge was all about how do we show the culture and the technology being, you know, more advanced, and how do we compare and contrast, and, oh, there's a Klingon on the bridge. But And you had some of that growing pains with Enterprise starting off. How do we, you know, only it was in production. How do we show a ship older than Kirk's but with technology 20 years, you know, and visual effects 20 years later or 40 years later than the 60s were? I had a thread here going with this somewhere. But some of the dilemmas they had with Enterprise, it's striking me how they were some of the same things they were that they were dealing with on the original series. And when this comes back to me fully, I'll get back to it.
Well, I mean, you actually tackle this a little bit in a couple of your segments in the third part of the documentary called Final Approach. And I want to ask all three of you your reactions to these two particular segments that Larry was featured in. The first part, it was the opening. And you said, Larry, you said that the idea of a Trek show could just die was unheard of at the time. And this would have been in 2005, 2004, mm-hmm. 2005. It wasn't going to seven seasons and maybe even movies. UPN wasn't even seen. This is what boggles my mind. UPN wasn't even seen in all markets. Its programming was often preempted, which made it really hard for Enterprise to succeed. I think he even mentioned that it was preempted for sporting events or local news. Let's start off with Jeff. Jeff, I mean, we've had this conversation before. I mean, you had to feel that. I mean, even in our market, you had to feel that when you kind of started feeling, for lack of a better term, the death knell of what was happening with Enterprise.
Well, even when it was going on, I saw the parallels to the original series. I mean, they almost got canceled, and then they just barely got renewed, and then they got moved to the, you know, Friday nights, and I was like, this is probably going to be the last season, even though everything else had gone 7 years before it. I just kind of saw the writing on the wall when season 4 came out, and I figured this was probably going to be the end, and I was just glad that it went out with really strong for the final season.
Except for that last one.
Yeah.
How dare you? And we'll get to that later.
Well, the final episode got redeemed in the books, at least.
And not the entire final episode. The Archer speech bits made a lot of sense. It was just that weird little plot. It was so annoying because it went back to, it's like all of a sudden after a year, Rick and Brandon like jerked it back and wrote. And I just remember reading the script and watching those scenes and going, well, we're back to not naming the aliens. Either a species or, you know, alien kidnapper. Alien, like, what are these species? Can you at least give them a name? Because they're all like one-offs that don't have any bearing on anything. I was like, yep, okay, we're back to the not fanboys writing a script again.
I mean, Jolene was really mad, right? I think that was the one of her few really animated segments on the entire documentary was her just talking about how she's like, I said some things which I probably shouldn't have said.
Yeah, that cannot be understated.
Right? And I probably agree with her, right? If she, coming off of Terra Prime and Demons and how strong it was, and then this is the finale, like, I would have probably said the exact same things. I think it's really interesting.
Her tea and crumpets line will always be etched in my at the time when she was giving, it was about like, a lot like Robert Beltran the last couple of years of Voyager. When she was talking about, she was talking about Rick, and she said, yeah, someone's sitting off in their tea and crumpets in their ivory tower having golf every other day or something like that, where she was talking about not being hands-on with the show and not being available to solve problems. And it's like, wow, that's out in the open. Okay, short life on this show. Yeah,
throwing bombs.
I mean, I don't. I'm not sure if that was on the the documentaries. Is that something that she's been quoted?
No, I'm talking. No, I mean it was in the news at the time.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah. These were things that she was saying publicly. Mm-hmm. At
right.
the time.
You remember Jeff? Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
The tea and crumpets line. I will always remember that. Going, wow. Okay.
And then there was there was John's line in the documentary about like they never quote me, but the one time they quote me was when I said, "Man, they screwed right. the fans." The one time. Which is, I mean, I love the fact that they're honest because they knew it was the end, right? So they could be really liberated to say all these things. But it was pretty damning. And I can't say that I blame them. I know where they're coming from. And it was, yeah.
But, I mean, Anthony Montgomery brings this point up. I think Scott does too. And I also believe that John brings this up. And this is the other part, the other question that, Larry, you're featured in. And you said that Enterprise overlapped with Battlestar Galactica Season 1, and Battlestar mm-hmm. Galactica was considered a breakout hit for that year. Enterprise was judged as a network show and Battlestar Galactica as a cable show. So for Battlestar Galactica, the ratings were good, but you say ironically, it still had fewer viewers in raw numbers than Enterprise mm-hmm. did in Season 4, but the standards were different. What standards are we talking about?
Well, we're talking about... again, the perception in Hollywood ease, and a lot of this has gone away with the era of Netflix and DVD and on-demand and streaming and, you know, and binge-watching and all that. But back when we were still clinging to, you know, the aired weekly numbers of The King, somebody pointed this out either right at the end of the season or at the end of the show or within a year or so to me, that UPN, despite being, like you said, the crippled little network that only had maybe 80% penetration in the markets or whatever, and it would be on, you know, like Channel 37 Buffalo, oh, we're preempting for Sabres hockey or something, whatever. They would, because UPN came along so late, they didn't get the primary numbers. And we've gone so much with cable now that that's a little less important, but still. And the lesser stations that were making up, that weren't networks, or they were cheap networks, or they were making their revenue by having... sporting events, just like a lot of radio stations carry sports that preempt their regular programming. But the fact was that UPN, and after 11 years, the WB they started at the same point. The WB even was way far ahead of building an audience and an identity than UPN was because of its three or four eras of failed management or just Keystone Cops management. But Enterprise came out in the weekly ratings. The whole thing with Next Gen and DS9 even, was that every week they would come out with the special syndicated market ratings that were compiled because if you were a network show, you were on this, theoretically, you were on at 8 o'clock Monday or you were on at, you know, 9 o'clock Thursday or whatever it was. If you were a syndicated show, each market puts you on at a different space. So sometimes Next Gen would be on at 6 on Saturdays or 7 on Saturdays or 10:30 on Sunday nights if you were in Oklahoma City. You know, wherever it was through the week. And in L.A., it was the first night. Monday was the first night of the week for the syndication week for Next Gen, and it was always at 8 or 9 o'clock on Monday nights in L.A. and a lot of other places. So you never got that head-to-head comparison. So the Nielsen ratings were meaningless. You had to have a special service. There were a couple of ones, NTI, and then I think Nielsen's had a syndicated, but NTI was bigger because that's what the promotion people would always quote. But they would take market by market by market, and they had formulas, and they would put it together, and they would come up with a total audience like raw numbers and a couple other figures. And then by the time Next Gen got to be such a hit by the fourth and fifth and sixth seasons, they could put those numbers together and go, look, it's not a network show, but it's got better numbers than Roseanne. It's got better numbers than Cheers. It's got better, you know, and they would go through all these known network hits and go, look, you know, it's got better ratings than the World Series. It's got better, you know. That would make an impact in a Variety or a Hollywood Reporter ad, in a trade paper ad. And that's when Next Gen people got on the radar screens of Hollywood suits and people who dealt in the industry. Oh, look, it's not just this syndicated show on crappy little, you know, whatever. Despite all that, it's breaking through and it has huge numbers. So the whole thing of Voyager and then Enterprise being on a network was at last. We won't have to go through all those contortions. We can just see the numbers. And, of course, that's when... After the big splashy pilots, that's when the numbers started going down. And people are like, well, what's the big deal here? So after 7 years of guaranteed, you know, being the golden child of Voyager, and then a couple of years of that with Enterprise and then the game changing, to where Moonves finally gets rid of the goofy little UPN management after its third or fourth iteration and says, we're just going to run you ourselves. And oh, by the way, all you people, you've got to, it's Hollywood, it's reality. It's, this is the real world. Get your numbers up or you're out of here. Yeah. No favored nation. So being on that thing, it was always down in the 90s. And saying that they were the highest rated show on UPN was, you know, damning with faint praise. So, yes. Right, right. So Galactica was in a cable network. It was this big hit. It was, oh, it's so dark and gritty, and we all know what happened with Galactica. But it was on a cable satellite. You know, it was on Sci-Fi. So it was like USA and all those. So, yeah, the actual numbers, when you actually did the math, was about a million more viewers in a show for Enterprise than Galactica. But that's all the background going into that. But that's the way Hollywood perceived things. So they were, it was like big fish, small pond, small fish in a big pond.
You know, the one thing that, and it still kind of boggles me a little bit, that in this last, well, actually, this is the third of four of the documentary segments. 23 out of the 30 minutes, it was about, you know, these all of these different, you know, anecdotes of why the show was going down. But 7 minutes of it was dedicated to the last show, the very last show of Star Trek ever. These are the Voyages.
Did you count those minutes, Norm? That seems very precise.
I did. I did because I wanted more. I wanted to know. Well, A, they alluded to, or Manny alluded to the fact that Rick and Brandon always wanted to do the last show. And the reason, I don't want to spend too much time on it, but, you know, we have to acknowledge the fact that we're talking about a documentary that's mentioning the very last show of the very last series of all of Star Trek. And
So far.
Okay. Yes. The reason why and the choices that were made, and Rick coming in after all this time. I mean, he wasn't really all that involved with Enterprise after the first season. So he wanted to come back and do this. I'm going to put this to you guys. Do you think it was just a matter of hubris? Like, I'm Rick Berman. I'm Brandon Braga. This is our show. We're going to do what we need to do. Was it really a Valentine? Is there something that's, I don't know, that they wanted to just to leave behind with the fans? Obviously, a lot of fans don't really sit well with the way that These Are the Voyages was executed. But was their heart in the right place? That's the most important thing. Because did they do it for the right reasons and it just came out wrong? Or did they do it because it was just a matter of pride and we wanted to say, like, hey, we ran this show for 18 some odd years. We have the right to do this even though it wasn't the right thing to do.
Honestly, I think it's the latter. Because I think there's a really telling remark by Chris Black, I think, in another segment where he says, no one sets out to make bad television. No one sets out to do this. And I actually mentioned this on Earl Grey when we did the These Are the Voyages for their podcast. That episode would have been great if it wasn't the finale. It would have been great as inserted, let's say, in a season five. Dare I say, if Enterprise had gone to season five or somewhere down the road.
Dare ahead.
I know, right? It would have been great as, like, you know, that kind of alternate universe take or very, like, sweet or, like, you know, winking at the fans. If it was just a two-parter or if it was just an episode in the middle of a season. But for the fact that it was coming off of such a strong run of shows and that it was coming towards the end, I think their intentions were right. I think for them it was very much a Valentine for Star Trek when in reality fans wanted an ending to Enterprise. And I think there was this disconnect with them coming in because they were so removed from the fourth season. They felt like since this was the end of this show and for Star Trek in the foreseeable future, they wanted to do this and it was their prerogative. And I think Manny just kind of had to back away from it. I think they meant it with the right intentions, but it was really just interpreting the fans, I think it was just reading the fandom in the completely wrong way. I think they meant it in the best possible way, but they really should have been able to read the fans in a much better way. And they couldn't do it because arguably they weren't there for the fourth season. They were just doing it because it was the last Star Trek episode, period. When in reality, I think the fans wanted the finale to be about Enterprise.
Jeff, I want you to give the listeners out there that very special story of what happened to you when you were going to watch the finale of Enterprise, and how did you feel about that? I mean, how did you feel about what did you take away from it? Did you feel that it was the Valentine that you wanted, or was it something else?
Was it the box of Valentine candy full of dark chocolate coconut?
Half-eaten candy.
Or really bad apricot pits in the... No, what?
No, I've shared the story a couple of times now, but yeah, I was stationed in Las Vegas. I was in the Air Force at Nellis Air Force Base at the time, and I had gotten tickets to go see both the second part of the Terror Prime Demons two-parter and These Are the Voyages. They were both airing back-to-back that night. We were going to see them on the big screen in the Borg 4D theater at Star Trek The Experience, and
The Experience was still in existence then.
Yes, and I missed the bus because I didn't have a car at the time, and I had to catch the bus to get down to the Strip, which it was like a 10-15 minute drive from the base, and I missed the bus, and they wouldn't let me in. So I was very disappointed that I missed it, and then I finally got to see it probably a day or two later after getting home, and was even further disappointed by what I had seen, because, I mean, I'd heard all this stuff they're saying. It's a Valentine to the fans, and I see this, and I'm like, you know, what the hell is this? And, you know, I was like, you know, did they even watch any of the fourth season before they wrote it? You know, a lot of this development for the characters seemed to have been ignored, you know, and some things just seemed very random, and it just felt out of place to me. And then there was the whole part with being holograms, and I was like, are they saying that the whole show was a hologram?
And Jolene thought so.
Yeah, and even she was saying even to this day she's not sure if she was or not. And it was more confusing than it needed to be. I understand what they were trying to go for, and you know, I think their heart was in the right place. They were trying to say, you know, build a bridge between the Next Generation and Enterprise, and it's like, you know, Next Generation crew are looking back on the events of this time period using the holodeck, and I can understand where they were trying to do with that, but it just fell flat. It didn't work for me. I was pretty displeased with it. You know, 10 years later after they launched, and Mayweather is still an ensign. I mean, it's worse than Harry Kim.
That's true.
And you know, it just never sat very well with me. I didn't enjoy it, but I've kind of learned to live with it, especially now that they addressed it in the books. And you know, I can kind of accept it, you know, because I understand what they were trying to do with it.
Now, Larry, we saw you in the group scenes at the end, and you were obviously there on set because you were on camera. It may not be in the Blu-rays, but what was just the general overall feeling, if you can remember, you know, maybe like a little 5-minute segment of just how did you feel? What was the feeling on set? What was just the general attitude at the time?
Well, I mean, I remember, I think in the writers' reunion, I think Mike mentions hearing when the show was formally canceled because it was 3 days after Babel 1? It was the Babel 1 trilogy, their show in that they really enjoyed doing, and then they found it. But I also remember because they were filming either part 1 or part 2 of In a Mirror Darkly, and all the Enterprise bridge sets and the Vulcan landing foot from the T'Planahath was up on stage. All that stuff was up, and everybody had been having such a good time running over and taking pictures and enjoying watching all that happen, and then having the... And people actually starting to dare to think that maybe all this was going to save them another year. And then it came down, and people were like yanked back to normal. And everybody, those last weeks and months around the lot, you know, being melancholy, determined to get through. No one's quitting. People were all giving their all, the actors, the crew, everybody. But as the closer it got on, they couldn't help. There was a little undertow of that. And there was a very practical thing because some of the people, and they took a group picture. There's about 15, 18 people in this. The people who had been working on modern TV Star Trek since the pilot, since Farpoint. And a lot of people, even if they hadn't worked all 18 years, even just 5, 6, 8, 10, 12 years since late Next Gen or whatever, there are a lot of people who professionally had worked on Star Trek for that long. And it's like any industry. When you're it's like the good side is you've got a steady job, but the bad side is it's like you've been in a deep freeze and you haven't been out there.
Larry, let me interrupt you for 1 second because you just basically crossed into my end of an era part four introduction.
Okay.
So
No, it's fine.
It's just
the mood for that last day.
Yeah, this because that's how it kind of like segues from the part three to part four, and you're right in the middle of it because you actually talk about this.
Okay, well then that's why it's coming up. Yeah. So that last shoot's what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was very bittersweet, and I remember people kind of snapping out at the time and looking at me and saying, "Gee, how's the communicator and the fan club going to be?" And I was like, "Oh, we'll be okay till the next thing comes out." Not knowing that Decipher would go downhill and that Viacom would split and that. Almost all the entire terrain of Star Trek, no matter what corner you occupied.
Oh, you were there for the Decipher days too, huh?
I edited Communicator from 98 on. So yeah definitely. Yeah. But at the time, I remember in the spring, people would kind of go, "Wow, what are you going to do?" And it's like, "Oh no, we've got tons of stuff to talk about, you know, after the show's down." Before knowing what was going to happen with the next year. But no, it was a bittersweet day. And Majel and Rod came down as they had done at the end of all the other shows. It was just more public. It was a lot like it was really interesting because the mix of people, most of the people on Enterprise were Voyager people that came over, with the exception of like the art department guys who weren't on working both shows anyway. But most of the crew types were through the lineage of Next Gen through Voyager into Enterprise. So the memory of what Ira and the producers did for the last day of DS9, you know, the infamous Vix Lounge scene where they had all the guest extras and some of the alien guys out of their makeup were in the audience, and it was a really emotional thing. It was like a senior day, and it was the last day, and people running around, you know, people who weren't in the show were coming in, and scripts and call sheets and people signing stuff like it was after the graduation party. It was that same thing. The Next Gen's last day and Voyager's last day were just little insular, not built into anything like that. And they kind of just quietly, for different reasons. Next Gen was, "Hurry up, we have to get out of here so we can have 2 weeks to rest up so we can come jump in our movie." And Voyager's was like, "Would you all hurry up and get off the stages so we can build these new, cool, exciting things for Enterprise?" It was kind of like a, you know, don't let the door hit you on your butt on the way out the door. Enterprise, they made this concerted effort to have an event. And having that guest extra scene in the audience was part of that. And it was very cool. And to me, that as much as everybody hates the way adventure, you know, the actual mission scenes of These Are the Voyages comes out, it is a very sweet, bittersweet, and cool day. It was like a Vix Lounge scene when we shot the guest extras with the green screen to hear Archer's speech. And unlike DS9, when I left about midnight, I stayed for the whole damn thing because they shot the shuttle pod scenes and they shot Phlox and T'Pol with Archer before he goes out to make the speech. That scene, they actually shot that bit last. And it was all some like new sets that they had to build. And watching not just the crew, but watching the cast. I mean, watching, you know, Connor and Scott hug, and watching everybody say their goodbyes, and just it was that same. It was just like senior graduation day, and realizing that it had piled up like that on other shows, with the added level of, and what a lot of people, and you've touched on this now, didn't realize just sitting at home watching that show go by and going, "Ugh." But that what permeated everything at the lot was that, and not even so much for the cast, because it was their show, but a lot of the crew from Rick and Brandon down through a lot of that crew, it wasn't just the end of this four-year show. It was the end of an era. It was the end of their 10, 12, 15, 18 years working. And that did permeate everything. And for better or worse, it permeated the show, and that informed some of the writing choices they made. And at the same time, I think the little visual effects bit at the end, I think the Kirk, you know, voiceover segueing into Picard's voiceover with the appropriate ship, and then letting Archer say "where no man's gone before" at the end, and having NX-01 fly off, I thought that was very sweet. And what you were just talking about was that came out of the same place that their choices for the show came out of. They were totally wrong, and there's a piece of me wanted to say, "Well, guys, I don't think anybody blames you for wanting to come back and do this last show, not just because the end of the series, but because it's the end of 18 years. And that's the way they looked at it, especially, much less a lot of other people. But this is this episode, this is why we wound up in this place in the first place. It's kind of like, this is how we got here, remember? And I just remember feeling like whiplash, like, oh, wow, okay, we suddenly went from the Manny season back to, you know, the not totally TOS-informed direction and vibe of things. So I just remember it kind of being a whiplash and going, really? Really? And like I said, it was kind of like, well, look, none of the aliens have names or species names. Yep, we're back to, you know, just come up with some cool makeup kind of stuff. And yeah.
Yeah, that was another thing that really got me was it's the last episode of Enterprise, and you see the Enterprise D through the entire episode up until the final scene when you finally see the NX-01.
Right. So that's actually a good, I was going to ask you, ask you this, Larry. The sets for the Enterprise D that they're walking, did they rebuild parts of that for that
yes,
episode?
Yes, and I took, oh, by the way, I took pictures of all this stuff. I have it put back, yeah. No, they got, the holodeck door had been in storage, and they pulled that out, and they built, they had the observation lounge table had been used for the ease table, so they had it stored. So, and this is, you know, this is before all the big Christie auctions in 2006. So a lot of the stuff was still safely stuck in warehouses because nobody knew what was coming down the pike. So no, they rebuilt that corridor turn, and they rebuilt the holodeck door area. And I want to say something else, but no.
But it's not quite the same.
A lot of this is some green screen, not a lot, but the doorway and the corridor and something else. Can't remember what it was.
Was it the ships? The golden ships and the observation lounges, the Enterprises?
At that point, they didn't have the golden ships up on the wall.
Yeah, because I was going to say, it looked different when they're in the observation lounge. It looked different.
Because that was only up for like the first two seasons, I think.
Yeah, well, no, they went down for Star Trek VI, and then Richard James didn't like them, and so they, like between 4 and 5, I think. So they went away, and then Ron Moore rescued them, and they stayed at his garage. Until the statute of limitations had run out, and you could talk about it, but they did build a lot of that. That was what was charming, though. I mean, at the time, thinking, well, this is cool, but I do remember at the time also just being people there. I know that Jonathan and Marina, the day we shot the extra scene, and they were up in the back for a lot of it. Did have this? I didn't really talk to them much because there was so much going on, but there was kind of an uncomfortability, like, of course they were happy to come in and work and do the thing and play their roles, but I think they felt like they were intruding, like, shouldn't this be their party, you know? Mm-hmm. Shouldn't it kind of be their show? And it wasn't even like they were a cameo. It was like, no, we're the narrative envelope for the whole thing.
They are the through line.
Yeah, they're the through line. So it's, I remember them at the time feeling, it was like you said, if it had been a show in the middle of a season, people would have felt more on the ground of critiquing and going, well, this is not going to be, you know, well, this show is a dog. Oh, this is such a cool show. Whatever the vibe was. But people were so wrapped up in the emotion of the ending that even their normal levels of, you know, individual show critique were kind of frayed a little bit. Because people were just embroiled in the emotion of the ending. And whether that was looking back or whether that was, holy fuck, I've got to go, oh, excuse me, holy, you know, I've got to go out and find a job for the first time in 15 years somewhere else, you know, yeah. And being paranoid about that, because that's a real world concern that was underlying a lot of the emotion. It wasn't just people's sentimentality. They were talking, like I said, it's like being in a deep freeze for 15 years. And sometimes those are good stats, but sometimes a lot of shows, depending on what your field is, they go, wow, so you've done Star Trek for 15 years. Okay, do you know we use digital cameras now? Or do you know, you know, whatever it is. We don't use rubber heads here. It's just straight ahead makeup, you know, or whatever.
Oh, sure. It's very insular. And you can tell. I mean, just to kind of like encapsulate this last segment, the one thing that I really took away from this last part, you could just feel in Mike Okuda's stories and his memories just how fond he was of working those, like, all that time. Mm-hmm. But the emotion that I think he's actually holding back and the reservation that he has is just, it's admirable, because you know that he wanted to pour his heart out on the camera, but I don't think he's that guy. I don't know him from Adam, but, you know, he's just, you know, he's like, he's very grateful. He is, you know, sitting next to Denise, and they were saying that we've done this together, you know, drive in, probably have our morning coffee, talk about daily life, hit the set, work, come back home, probably talk about work, wash, rinse, and repeat for what, 18 years?
Yeah, they were, yeah. Well, Mike was. Denise came in four, five, 6 years into it. But right, yeah, Mike had. Mike was one of the first four, five, six people hired. Mike was one of the people that he and Rick were hired before Herman was on season one of Next Gen, because it was like Bob just, they were so paranoid about being behind to get stuff going, you know, from square one, that Mike had worked on Star Trek IV and it was just like everybody else. Oh, I kept it. I've got your phone and I'd love to drop my portfolio off. And, you know, that look that he brought to the A revamped, you know, the all gleaming white A bridge at the end of four, at the end of the wheels, at the voyage home.
That was the birth of the Akutagram was in.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. That? And that technology of, no, we don't have to sculpture and put a lot of bulbs and whistles and things, textured panels. We can just print out these film things and have it look high tech and sleek. And, oh, that's great. And that was part of what sold him, you know, to Bob. It was like, here's a whole new concept for doing this. And they were like, great, fine, sold, bang. Quick, cheap, and it looks great. I love it. Go.
And just one last thing on this segment, because I really do think he was being very sincere about it, and it was really nice to have Brandon end the segment. But he said that he reflects that his time on Enterprise was bittersweet. Mm-hmm. He said he felt when he burned out, but he says, and I believe it, he says that time heals all wounds, as they say, and not just for him, but for the fans as well, because a lot of fans are coming back to it. I worked a convention earlier on this year in Anaheim called WonderCon, and there were mm-hmm. fans that were coming up talking about Enterprise. They must have been like 18 years old, 19 years old. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, what brought you to watching this show? And they said, well, the JJ movies were the introduction, but because Enterprise was the newest, the earliest in the timeline, but also the newest as the franchise,
right,
they said it was the easiest connection to make. And then they just kind of like worked backwards, because they went from Enterprise to Voyager to Deep Space Nine. And I found that really charming, because it's available now. And there isn't the gravitas of all the drama and all the politics. They're just watching it purely for the content, which I think is fantastic. And they're making the judgment based on, does this entertain me? Is this Star Trek to me? And do I connect with these characters? And there was a lot of just a resounding yes going on there, and I found that fantastic. So yes, I know that there were the problems, and you know, in wrapping up all of our deliberations and all of our research and all of our discussions on seasons 1 through 4, I think it is fair to say that Enterprise for me is the series that probably just had the most heart. They tried so hard against probably the most insurmountable odds. They succeeded at many levels. They were challenged at many levels, and they hit some pretty low notes. But all in all, it's a fantastic series to watch. And if you love Star Trek, you owe it to yourself to watch it, at least just for the continuity and for understanding how it fits into the timeline. So as much as I would love to get into the writing part, the writer's staff documentary, which is another 90 minutes of...
It's amazing.
You're getting the most bang for your buck.
Mike Sussman, Andre Bormanis, David Goodman, Chris Black, Phyllis, the Reeve Stevens, and unfortunately Manny. I mean, there's still a ton of content there. So that's in the Blu-ray.
Unfortunately, Manny missed it. That's what you should.
And Manny missed it. Right, yes. Manny missed it. Yeah. And just, you have, you know, if you have the means or if you can borrow it, heck, call me. I will lend you my copy. You know, you have to watch these. You know, yeah, you have to watch these. As an Enterprise fan, you owe it to yourself. As a fan of Star Trek, at least to understand what happened, because it's not what you think all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, like Will, you said this perfectly, and you were quoting it was either Brandon or one of the writers. They're not out to make poor quality product. Nobody does that. They're out to make the best quality product they can. The challenges were there, and it's just being flexible enough to overcome those challenges is where you had your peaks and valleys. And, you know, if you really look at Enterprise, there were a lot of really good peaks. There were some pretty significant valleys, but there were some really good peaks. And you always appreciate it and accept it how you are, how your mentality is watching it. You know, if you wanted to hate it because you wanted to hate on Star Trek at the time, you're not going to find a lot there. If you want to just watch it with refreshed and renewed vigor 10 years later, I think you're going to find a lot of value in that show. So for me, just trying to wrap up this entirety of these four DVDs, I give this one probably my highest recommendation because of that documentary. It's four 30-minute segments, and I give it my highest rating. How about you guys?
I feel like I need to give you one of those slow claps Saval gives to Archer's speech because it was so good. Like, you know, the slow clap where everyone starts clapping. Like, yeah, that was a good
speech. Is funny because that's an emotional outburst. And for Vulcan leading that charge, it was, you know, where Saval's, you know, he was, the emotions were right up
there.
That's
true. Yeah, I think I can only echo your thoughts on that. And I love the fact that because, ironically enough, because Enterprise was the last, so far, the last Star Trek series to be made, and because there's been so much time that's passed since that, and because it was an end of an era of Trek, the Blu-ray's features here have such a wealth of information because of the unique position the Enterprise is in, that you get to have such a retrospective on the entirety of the franchise. So you have Brannon and Rick being very honest with each other. You have Manny being very honest. You have the actors being very honest with each other. And there's a lot that's also not said to you. I'm a big fan of reading body language, and I've mentioned this before in earlier podcasts. Although we learn a lot from this stuff, there's also so much more I'm sure they're not telling us. And I'm sure there's so much there that you can kind of read between the lines too. And there's so much going on with this show, which is what makes it so interesting to talk about, despite only having four seasons. I mean, all the other series have seven seasons or they have movies, but you know, this is just four seasons, that's it. But because of where it sits in this weird, not weird, but very particular timeline of, it's the first chronologically in universe, but it's chronologically the last. So it's in this weird cross zone of being early and late, but because it's also the last Trek series before JJ, there's so much wrapped into it. And it's so interesting. And I think that's what makes Enterprise so fun to talk about. It's what makes this show fun to talk about every week. And yeah, Enterprise has a lot of underrated value. I think people are now just discovering it now. And my one regret is, you know, is the what if, because I think if they got additional seasons, you know, Manny Coto could have been the showrunner for an entire, dare I say, another generation of Trek. There might not have been a JJ Trek if they'd been able to survive. I know that pretty much by the fourth season, they knew they didn't survive. But it's really interesting to say that right around now, they're really starting to hit their stride. I mean, if certain dominoes had fallen a different way, we could have had three more years of Trek in a complete different Trek universe than we have now. And it's so interesting to think about that Rick Berman could have passed and Brandon Broad could have passed it to a new quote-unquote showrunner for all of Trek. And I think that's really interesting to think about.
I agree with you, Will. I found these, the documentaries on this were just really interesting. And like I said, there were things that they talked about that I didn't even know about. And considering all the knowledge that I've accrued over decades of immersing myself in this, that says something. I really enjoyed the fourth season just from the stories and the episodes, but the extra things that I learned from all the documentaries on this, you know, not just the ones that are exclusive on the Blu-ray, but also the ones that were carried over from the DVDs, is just really interesting material. And there's hours and hours and hours of it on there. And it's just so much stuff on all of these Blu-ray sets. It's just a wealth of material on there.
And how about you, Larry? Your final thoughts?
Yeah, and I had the privilege of getting to talk on this one a lot. Or they used it, like, they didn't use anything on season three, but apparently they saved it all for this year. Mm-hmm. But the next, you were talking about the irony of timing, and I used to think about that as in terms of the, like I said, like how do you do prequel the '60s show, but with aughts technology, you know, versus '60s TV production technology. But it is in a unique place. The Next Gen and the Enterprise documentaries, I guess the original series too, but it seems increasingly so because so many of the people who would speak on the original series documentaries aren't with us anymore because of just the immense time. But the Next Gens were refreshingly honest and people got to talk, and like Michael's not around, but Ira got to talk about the third season. They did not get into the stuff that Shatner's recent documentary did with Maury Hurley, who passed away, who I tried to talk to two or three times and never wanted to talk. I just think they had to have thrown a ton of money at him to do that. And then he died very soon after that was produced, which was kind of amazing. So the next gens are very, they enjoy, the next gens and the Enterprises enjoy the place of time of nobody has a job to protect anymore. The original, even the original Enterprises were done within, if not the end of, no, they weren't done at the end of Enterprise, but within a year or two, people still felt very fresh and raw or close to it. And people, you know, it's just like the psychic statute limitation had not run out to a comfort zone yet, to where people hadn't worked two or three more jobs. It just hadn't passed by. And a lot had been said on Next Generation. They weren't so revelatory except for a couple of places. But even more so with the Enterprises here, people felt free, even in groups, people felt freer to, you know, they didn't have a job to protect, and they didn't worry about, well, if I want to work with him again sometime even, or get cast with them sometime again. So people did just feel very fresh. So it's, and I hadn't thought about it so much as far as the tech, but I think it was, Will said this too, or maybe Norm, you said this about the fans, because I've had the same thing too. And like I said, I love Doug's line about we've had a whole new generation of Enterprise fans who don't know they're supposed to hate the show. And for whatever reason, that HD Blu-ray hoop that people get over before they're attracted, you know, it's the initial thing. Before they get sucked in and seduced by the stories and the characters, it's what their preconditions are, their preconceptions are about the presentation. And, oh, if this is HD and this is modern effects versus I can never watch those original series shows with the cheesy effects and the, you know, pajama costumes and everything. But then they eventually get into it because they're drawn by the story and the characters. And that is a great bonus. And the idea that it is, because I've had people come up to me who said, no, it's not because of JJ. I just had people who beat on me for years, you should be watching Star Trek, and they pick out something and they go. Or it's been the Netflix and then these box sets with the great, you know, presentation and the new features. And that's what gets them in, or especially with the Netflix free streaming. But there is a whole new, you sound like an old man there, Norm. There is a whole generation of people who are not part of the, not even the knowing the politics, just the week-to-week waiting. And sometimes that feels sad, like, oh, they'll never know what it was like to wait over Best of Both Worlds summer, you know, and have that agony. On the other hand, it's cool that that's the way it will be. I mean, that's where the original series has been for years. There's going to be more and more, fewer and fewer people who watched it week-to-week, and more people who will know Star Trek as a thing, they go into the big wall of boxes and pull down, or the big wall of icons on Netflix and choose what they want to watch and then binge watch it. So it's really interesting to think that the failed show now is the one that may be people's first stop coming in. But the set is amazing. I forgot until I got back to it. That is, it's 2 hours of docs and a 90-minute special. It's just amazing. And it's well done and very refreshingly honest. And I'm really, really, really glad these got done, even if we'll never have any more. You know, Voyager and DS9 never get the same treatment, or at least for a long time. It is. It's really, really great. And anybody that just wants to know how TV is, it's just like going back to Stephen Poe's original classic, Making a Star Trek book. Even if you're not the biggest Star Trek fan, just knowing the vibe that actors and writers and production people have as a place to work and try to be creative, it's just invaluable to see how people just carry themselves and talk. Because, I mean, I got to witness that myself, and that informs everything I do. And this is a great introduction to that ease and familiarity and going, oh, how do I look at this without just being the person sitting at home watching it every week? It was a place where they worked and where they got frustrated and where they, you know, where 9/11 happened while they were at work and what it was like for them that day. So all of that stuff, it's just, if you're really going to step up and be a deep dive fan, it's, yeah, you just have to.
No, I absolutely agree. And I think that's one of the reasons why we wanted to tackle this. And these are my final thoughts here for the show. It's because they're not just great products, because they are. And I was really disappointed in the DVD release, because we knew that it was shot a certain way, and DVD can only provide a certain amount of quality. And, you know, your final output, your maximum output, it's your maximum output. You can't get any more than 420 lines per screen, you know. But when it came out finally in HD, and finally they actually made the concerted effort to get all of these documentaries done, to get the crew together, to get all the writers together, to get all these memories down for posterity and memoriam, that's worth its weight in gold, especially if you can get it at the discounted price that they're offering at right now. I encourage anybody to watch Enterprise. And if you want to watch it on, you know, Hulu and Netflix or however you want to get it, that's fine. But like you said, and I love that phrase you used, if you want to be a deep dive fan, if you want to go in all the way and maybe learn something, because I'm sure Tommy Kraft, you know, who is a huge fan of this, and you know, he's probably learned a great deal of what he needs to bring on Horizon from studying a lot of these archival documents. I mean, this is what you owe it to yourself to do that. And please do, because a lot of people put a lot of work into this, and it is the end of an era. I feel a little verklempt, you know, I'll use that word again, to come to the end of this this four-part or this fourth episode of talking about the Blu-rays, because in watching these Blu-rays, we're revisiting, at least the special features, we're revisiting why we love the show in the first place, why we love Star Trek in the first place. It's about, sometimes it's about the cast we love. And I love this cast, and I'm sure a lot of people do. But it's also about the people that are bringing us the show. And you're right, Larry. It's the Mikes, you know, and the Denises and the Dougs in the world. I wish we got to see Doug in some of these documentaries, because I don't think he's actually captured in any.
I think you see him exactly like once, you know, in the disc two, when he was talking about building the NX-01very quickly on in his living room. I think it's like the first set.
Oh, you're right. You're right. You're right. Yeah. You're right. And but it's not nearly enough for what he's contributed to the show. So. I mean, all of this, I could go on and on and on and on and on, and I stare at my podcast counter and it's getting a little too long, but I mean, it's really worth your while, and it really is just a fantastic series, fantastic product in the Blu-rays, and except for one, no, there's one thing I really did dislike about all of them, and those were the director's chairs. It was the worst way to interview anybody ever. Those high back, or those high, you know, short back chairs, which made everyone feel automatically at the highest level of discomfort possible. So, but I don't want to end on a negative note. So anything else positive to say before I wrap this up?
We are getting a 5% cut of all the Blu-ray sales, which is why we've been hawking these Blu-rays so much. I'm just kidding.
I thought it was 7%. It's the 7% solution. So
4.7.
All right, guys. So guys, it's been my privilege, guys, to have you on the shows and to talk these Blu-rays. Thank you, Larry, so much for being on here, and especially for this one, because you were so heavily featured in the season four set. And but it's not the only thing that we've been talking about on Trek FM this past week. So here's a few other topics that we have been talking about elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
And the Slaver Weapon's the only episode of the original with no Kirk in it.
Nope, not there no yet. Spoilers, jeez.
Wait, there's no Kirk in that one? No. I didn't even know. I'm going to have to check that
it
out.
It completely takes place starting off with the shuttlecraft and only the people that are in the shuttle.
The Orb.
Well, apparently, and did you find this interesting, Matthew? Apparently, the Navark reports directly to the prophets.
Which is awkward, because they don't always show up for meetings, so...
Right.
Yeah.
Plus, you never know what time the meeting is really going to be, right?
That is true. It could have been yesterday, and you might have missed it.
The Ready Room.
Do you think this episode would have been so popular and remain a fan favorite if the Enterprise had been overrun with zebra mussels?
To the journey!
It's so average American. It's like Joe Smith. And no offense to Joe Smith, it's just, I could have tried a little harder. I mean, come on.
Might as well call her Jane Doe. So far, not off to a good start. So far, I'm judging you, Shark.
Give me a moment.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
One of the things that amazes me about the score for Star Trek The Motion Picture is that he only had 50% of the movie available to him when he scored. So he was scoring an awful lot to scene missing.
Women at Warp.
There's always a touchstone, and this was as close to a touchstone as they ever got with Pulaski.
Plus she banged Riker's dad.
Oh, Andy.
I'm sorry, I just think it's so funny.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So if you like what you heard tonight, and if you like what you hear on Trek FM, there's a way that you can help us out. We are an independently funded network, so we have a program that you may have heard of, or you may have heard me speak of on other shows, called Patreon. That's Patreon, and that's a way that you can help us fund the show. We have expenses that are included with the show in terms of like keeping our servers running and keeping all of the network ins and outs at full form, keeping the warp plasma injectors clean and making sure that the engines are running smoothly so we can hit that 5.1 eventually. But the one thing that is really amazing, and it's just taken off so well, is the Patreon Roundtable program. And Will, you've done a great job with this. You're getting so many people, so many new patrons coming to the website and supporting us and donating on a monthly basis. And I think it's largely due because they finally have a chance to meet all of us, the hosts of Trek FM, to talk about what they like about Star Trek. And I think the Roundtable is a huge success. So if you could just let the fans and the listeners know a little bit about what's going on with the Roundtable.
Yeah, so it's just a monthly get together with Trek FM hosts and patrons who donate at the $25 level or above, just to get together in a very informal and casual way just to talk about all things Trek. So it's in-universe Trek, out-of-universe Trek. We've talked about what brought us into Star Trek, what were our favorite moments in Star Trek, how it affected our social lives. So we're doing this. We just finished our third roundtable in August. We're going to have one this month. And hopefully we'll get more and more people involved, and I think one day hopefully we'll have Larry on the roundtable too. I think it'd be really, if you're interested, Larry, I think it's really great way for the fans and listeners to be involved, and for the hosts to talk to each other. Sometimes we do our own shows, we don't get a chance to talk to each other, so it's really great just cross-pollination of fun and ideas and just kind of overall geeking out. So I'm really pleased with how it's turned out.
And it's, I think it's a great program. You're right, it's growing leaps and bounds, and I mean, you have the Brady Bunch, pretty much the group of people that you take snapshots of. I think you were up to 9 last time.
Up to 9. Yeah, so I think with my Zoom account, I could do up to 25. So I don't know if it's going to be that crazy, but we'll see if we can push the envelope of how many people can be involved.
If we can get that many more patrons, that's going to be great. And for all you patrons, you know, you have all of these different types of exclusive perks. You have access to content that Will can provide for you, exclusive content you can talk to all the showrunners about. You have producer credits, which is kind of like the way that I came in on board as an associate producer for several shows. And you have seats on the content development team and a lot more. So thank you for supporting us, for those of you who are Patreons. And for those of you who are looking at supporting us, there are different ways for you to do that and at different flexibility and comfort levels as well. And I always have to say thank you to our associate producers for Warpfied, Floyd Dorsey and Mike Morrison. Thanks always for your support on Patreon and for always talking up Warp 5 and Trek FM on the Babel Conference, Trek FM's dedicated Facebook page, which we are all posting on all the time, because that is where you get the straight skinny and a lot of great conversation and a lot of Trek knowledge that is imparted on from all your hosts and from Dr. Trek himself, Larry Nemechek, who frequents the boards from time to time. Now, if you'd like to get in contact with us and see how you can get involved, or if you'd just like to leave us a message or a subspace signal as you prefer, you can always find us on trekfm/contact and look on the sidebar on the show page. You can always go on speakpipe.com/trekfm and leave us a voice message or a subspace signal as you prefer. You can always contact us through Twitter at trekfm, Facebook, facebook.com/trekfm, and as I mentioned before, the Babel Conference. Just type in B-A-B-E-L into the search field on Facebook, or go to our website and click Trek FM and the discussion on the menu bar. As I said before, we had some really fantastic conversation here. Thanks to Jeff, thanks to Will, and thanks to Larry. So Larry, I know you have a lot of followers, and I know that you have a lot of people who are interested in what you're going to have to say here on the podcast, but please let all of your listeners know how they can get in touch with you here on Subspace.
Well, Twitter Subspace is still at Larry Nemechek. That's pretty simple. Facebook is Larry Nemechek's Trekland. Website is LarryNemechek.com. And that's the gateway to everything from the Connor Rathma documentary that we're wrapping up to the Trekland trunk sales, information about our next year's huge 50th anniversary Geek Nation tours, L.A. to Vegas and San Fran Star Trek film site tours. We've got 20 people as of today signed up, and we max out at 35, which is huge. We're way ahead of where we've been with that forever, but that's not till next summer. But like everything else about next year for the 50th, people are jumping in early. And Enterprise in Space is my nonprofit that I, if you enjoy crossing over with supporting education efforts to get kids and grad students and the public excited about space again, that's enterpriseinspace.org that I'm a part of. And then very close to home here, end of September, I'll be at Salt Lake Comic Con. Looking forward to that. That's like the third largest con in the country now. And very, very, very excited on top of everything else that, and on speaker, if you enjoy these deep dives. I haven't done an Enterprise one yet. I'm going to have to figure that out, what next year's theme is going to be for my Trekland on speaker archival remastered interviews from the 90s and the aughts deep dive chunks of talking with some of these creators. I need to do an Enterprise one, though, sometime. But most of all, my Portal 47 that I'm just launching, we just had, by the time this airs, we just will have had the first startup call. So for right now, just go to the Facebook page, Portal 47. It may not be for everybody, but it's a boutique deep dive fan experience that I've been trying to put together for years. It's really unique and different, and we'll just check it out. That's what I'll say. I'll be mysterious about it, so you'll be entranced. But I'm really, really, really excited that we're getting it off the ground. Yeah, finally a way to, 21st century way to have a mini con all year long with people, hopefully, in a lot of different ways. So that's exciting. So, but thanks for having me on again, and got me back in touch with a very sweet, bittersweet time, and excellent, excellent DVDs. I know they didn't have a big budget on these, but they're just amazing.
No, and thanks for coming on, and you're welcome here anytime. I mean, you're welcome in the conference room, or if we have to throw you in the decon chamber for a minute or two, but thanks for coming on. You're
only
always
if I
on
get to pick the flavor of the gel.
Decon gel E. Uh-huh. I think we went all the way down there, so. okay, Jeff, and for you, let us know how the listeners can get in touch with you, you know, across subspace.
Well, I'm frequently on the Babel Conference and the Axanar fan group, posting there pretty regularly. I'm also on Twitter at Harlander, and I also have my comic books that we've discussed a few times. Just released a color edition of the first issue. I went back and colored it.
Of the Protectorate.
Yes, and it's that's available. You know, it's on bandwidthcomics.com. It's also on facebook.com/bandwidthcomics, and then I've got the Trekopedia, trekopedia.com, and I've been working on that whenever I can find time to spare on that. But I was actually just recently went on Standard Orbit and talked about that a bit too.
All right, Will, you're up, my man, so do the thing.
Yeah, so you can always reach me in the Babel Conference, like with all of you guys. It's our dedicated Facebook listeners group. I'm always in there almost every day. You can always tweet me at @will_win, spelled NGUYEN. And, you know, I'm also the content manager for the network. So if you have any ideas on what we should be talking about on this show or any other show and kind of direction of Trek FM and kind of fandom in general, please hit me up at any time. Always love to listen from you fans. And like I said, I'm also the host of the Patrons Roundtable. So if you guys want to get involved there, be sure to check us out at patreon.com/trekfm.
And just like the guys said, I'm on the Babel Conference pretty much posting daily because I love talking and tweeting and texting with all of you fine folk and our fantastic listeners there. You can also find me on Twitter, Norman Lau. That's NORMANLAO. You can always find me on the Axanar fan group page because I'm a huge supporter of that project, and I pretty much post there daily as well. And I'm a huge, you know, I love saying this because I always mean it, and I'm a huge sponsor of the show through the Patreon program, and I am an executive producer for Trek FM.
So thanks, everyone, for listening, and join us again next time in the conference room for another episode of Warp 5.